Film Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs. Ben Stark of Wondermill Films. Matt Scalisi, editor of filmnerds.com.
Interlocking, interlocking, cells, cells. Matt, are you on your baseline?
I'm way off, way off.
You're way off your baseline. Yeah, I can tell.
Yeah.
So we saw Blade Runner 2049, and we're here to talk about it. I guess just right off the bat, what did you think?
I mean, I think walking out of it, the overall kind of cohesive picture of it is really, really strong for me. I think, you know, I rewatched Blade Runner earlier this week, and, you know, it kind of reinforced a lot of the things that I remembered about it, but I think in a way it changed my feelings about it because I'm watching it, you know, in a different place and in a different place in my life, and it's very much, as we all, you know, you and I kind of discussed it a little bit too, it's a movie that I think works more as a piece of kind of, to use literary terminology, it's more poetry than it is prose. The plot doesn't always make a lot of sense, and that doesn't really matter, because it's just this incredible arrangement of images and ideas and a tone and a feeling that you get from the whole thing put together. And I think what 2049 does and what the director Villeneuve, I think, really got right is this movie mostly, I think, spends a lot of its time trying to operate on that level. You know, I don't think that it's, I think I was a little concerned when I first found out about this movie that what this was going to be is what we're seeing from a lot of these reboots of movies that we loved from 30 and 40 years ago, which is, hey, let's just take some little plot thread that was mentioned and we'll blow it up into a narrative. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's sort of done a tiny bit in this, but not really. I mean, I think this movie spends far, far more of its runtime just doing what the first movie did so well, which is walking around in this incredible world, which I think Villeneuve recreates really, really well. I don't think it feels any, most of the time it does not feel any more digitized or clean or all those things that we don't like about new special effects compared to late 70s, early 80s special effects. It has very, very much, I think, similar feel visually to the original. And we just get to walk around it and see these ideas and elements that are in it. And it's weird because it's not even so much a dystopian future when I watch it. That's not what it feels like to me. It feels much more like it gives me the feeling of I'm watching this world that doesn't exist anymore, a failed society, a failed world, you know? And I think that's really what the whole Blade Runner kind of mythos is about. It's about how it's sort of following the 80s ethos to its logical conclusion and saying, you know, if we just kept pushing commercialism like crazy and we kept pushing all the societal forces that are at work right now further and further, eventually it's going to be this horrible dystopia where we treat huge chunks of our people like they're not people.
Gonna be?
And, I mean, what's really weird is how many of these ideas felt like basically just a slightly transposed version of something that really does exist right now. You know,
mm-hmm.
It doesn't exactly look like that. You know, we don't really have holographic digital girlfriends, but people in 2017 essentially are filling the spaces in their lives with something almost identical to that.
Mm-hmm.
There are a million little things that hit me that way watching this movie where it does not, this is not like Minority Report where you got, the producers got a bunch of people together and said, hey, what are some cool ideas coming down the pipe that we think might be in the future? This is not about the future. This is about now all of these things that people thought were going to be cool 30 years ago, and they've turned into these sort of gross, failed systems
right.
that are just kind of rolling around us.
It's more akin to Children of Men, where they actually got sociologists or anthropologists around and said, okay, so extrapolating today's problems, what are going to be the problems in this future movie that we're making? And they're like, immigration. That's why immigration is such a huge part of Children of Men, and obviously it's accurate. This is definitely more in that line of it's not about, what's going to be cool in the future. It's like, based on what we got, if we keep going down this path, what's not necessarily, I mean, I guess kind of the worst case scenario. Maybe not the worst case scenario.
It's looking back more than it, the whole movie, I feel like all the characters are kind of walking around going like, none of this really worked out. Like, this all kind of ended up sucking. And I kept thinking watching it then that, are we about to enter this time where we get a lot of art that is not about hope and optimism, and it's about where did we go wrong? And this is not a movie that is, I would say, has a depressing message or a pessimistic message, but it does acknowledge the fact that these characters are in a broken world that is so incredibly broken that you could excuse any of them for feeling hopeless, and anybody in the movie that has hope becomes a remarkable character. Most of them are operating from a place of, fear and hopelessness and I think
disappointment.
It feels like, even though they must have been working on this movie for quite a while, this movie feels incredibly timely to me.
Yeah, I mean, look, all I hope is that we get more dark and gritty movies to speak to our time.
Can't get enough.
And now more. I think that, I don't know if it's the sign of the times or if maybe Denis Villeneuve is just ahead of the curve, but I think his last three movies now have all really spoken well to our current zeitgeist. He encapsulates this kind of existential dread that we find ourselves in as a society pretty well, especially in his last couple of movies. I mean, honestly, I've only seen Sicario, Arrival, and Blade Runner, but there's this kind of like sense of hope amidst hopelessness in all of those movies, like, okay, we're all helpless, so what do we do, kind of. And in a way, Blade Runner is the most hopeful of all of his movies that I've seen. But, yeah, I mean, I think going back to what you're saying earlier, I think that the tone is something that he really nails in this movie. And I love this movie, by the way, just get that out of the way. But, he definitely expands on the world of the original Blade Runner, and I do feel like it's a little bit more organic feeling in a way than that one, it's because I think we're seeing more, but also there seems to be, it's definitely like, there's like brighter lights, there is a little bit of more of a cleanliness than the original, but I think that's
only in
because,
a few places, honestly. To me,
but also it's because
I was
there
kind
has
of looking
been
for
a little
it.
Bit. There has been a little bit of, resurgence in the society thanks to Wallace, even though it's, through horrendous means. I feel like there is a subtext that there's a little bit of progress and that there is a little bit more order. That's kind of Robin Wright's. The stakes that she sets up is like, look, there's an order now, and the subtext, I think, is that, well, it's because we got back to slave labor. That's why there's order, and like, that's the cost of it, you know?
And we stopped taking care of people that were too difficult to take care of, and so there are, you know, orphan children living in garbage dumps and basically entire societies of people that live that have been forced outside of this big wall, and now we just don't have to worry about them anymore.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I hate to, I kind of hate to talk about it in context with the original, because, I mean, if I'm just going to pit the two movies against one another, which I don't think is really constructive, I do think that this new one, there is a bit of that magic missing, for whatever reason, from the original. I think it does a lot of stuff. Are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, there's a weird noise on my end, so I'll have to cut that out. There is a lot more, it doesn't have the magic of the original in terms of, like, I don't know, there's like this smoky mystery to the first one, that this one is a little cleaner, it's a little bit easier to understand, and,
I agree, but,
I mean,
I don't think that's an advantage. Like, I think this movie, when, and look, you and I had talked about it a little bit beforehand when we found out this movie was 2 hours and 45 minutes, I sort of complained a little bit and said, man, that is a lot to ask. And the only time, honestly, I was a little bit aware that I had made those comments to you when watching this movie, and I sort of noticed a few times and was like, you know, I don't even care how much of this runtime has left. Like, I'm in this movie. But the only times that it felt to me like it was dragging a little were, I think, when it became more concerned with plot and sort of detail. And so the scenes that involve kind of the revolution of the replicants, and that really, I know that I'm notably biased against this guy, but I did not enjoy Jared Leto's character or his performance as that character. And I felt those scenes, while they were shot really interestingly, and I think there was some craft and thought put into it, I didn't get a lot out of those scenes. They didn't really do very much for me. And they felt more like they were designed to have a feeling of sort of foreboding and mystery. And I don't really think they achieved it. I don't think they earned what was built around them. So, I mean, mercifully, those are not a big part of the movie. They kind of feel like connective tissue in this movie, and honestly, I don't think the movie would have suffered much without them, but I understand why they're in there. And, you know, again, I think they wanted to answer some questions about how this all worked and why people were doing what they were doing. And in the end, you know, I don't really care all that much. And I think it's somewhat because I've been conditioned by the first movie to know that's just part of the Blade Runner thing is, you don't really know who's real or who's not, and you don't know why people are doing what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I feel like the filmmakers knew that a muddy plot was kind of one of the only strikes against the original, and they kind of overreached, you know, a few times, kind of trying to clarify. Like you said, there's a few long exposition scenes, but there's also a few, like, I think that it flashes back to Batista's line about the miracle twice, and it's like, guys, like, I've been in the movie theater, like, I don't need to hear this again. You know, it's one of the things I don't like in movies in general when they flash back to, you know, audio of earlier in the movie. It's like, just drop a line and like let the performer remember it, and then I'll pick it up. You don't have to anyway.
Did it with the daughter too. They hammered that home to make sure that you didn't forget. Despite that, the two 80-year-old women next to me in the theater still forgot who she was.
Hey, that actress is fantastic. Like, whenever she
really
popped
looked,
up,
you know,
I was like enthralled.
When you get the reveal of who she is, you're like, you know what? She kind of does look like Sean Young. Like,
yeah, she does. Yep.
They cast it well. And I also think, by the way, they cast the recreation of Rachel really well, too.
Bro, that was CGI.
No, it was not.
Yes, it was.
No way.
Yes, it was. You couldn't tell? You're the second person today that I was like, yeah, totally CGI. Tell me.
I was watching it, and when they shoot her walking out, I thought, well, this is going to be CGI because that's how they're shooting it. And
yeah.
I honestly, dude, when the close-ups on her face, I'm not joking. If you hadn't
that's
told me
fine.
That, I would have thought it
look,
was real.
Look, that scene in general had some issues, and it got a little.
Oh,
bit
I'm with
wonky,
you. I'm with you on
a,
that.
A little
yeah.
bit wonky for me, and I was like, I made a decision in the theater when that happened. I was like, triggered, and then I was like, you know what? You know what? F that. I'm just gonna whatever. I'm gonna be in the moment and let it go. And you
yeah.
know, I do. I think that
real anyway. But
I think,
bought
yeah,
it.
Yeah, but
I
all the other ones
were
freaking real. But I don't know. For me, it was like, well, you know, there's a way you could have directed that scene where we know her silhouette, and what if you played the scene where you don't see her face and you just see her
close
reaction?
Too.
But
yeah.
whatever, they didn't do that, and that's fine. But what my big takeaway from that scene, which again, like you said, it's kind of rambling, it's kind of long. Leto's like, okay, why'd you cast Jared Leto for this? But
he didn't do anything with the character. That's my
yeah.
issue. It's like he specifically made sure that the voice for that character was going to have absolutely nothing memorable about it.
He looks like Jesus. Like, that's about the only... He looks like a white Jesus. And that's
evil
only,
Jesus.
Evil, blind, evil Jesus. That's the only kind of, like, thing I can think of. Like, why would you cast specifically Jared Leto? Why not cast an older actor, you know? Like, I don't know. Anyway, but the... My big takeaway from that scene was... Oh my God! Is this Harrison Ford's best performance, maybe ever? Like he is, like capital G great in this movie. I think in a very subtle way. He doesn't have a ton of screen time, but I feel like I don't know. Maybe it's because I've seen enough kind of flat, boring Harrison Ford performances over the last 30 years or so that this is such a shock. But I feel like he plays so much of his character understated. And there's, like, so much emotion brimming underneath him, but he's still, you know, he's still the same character from the first movie where he kind of buries a lot of it. I don't know. I just feel like he's doing a lot of heavy lifting here that I'm not accustomed to Harrison Ford doing, and I think that it was awesome. Like, it's one of my favorite supporting performances of the year at this point.
I think we saw some of this in The Force Awakens a couple
sure,
of
definitely.
Years ago.
Definitely.
And it's interesting that the two times now in recent years that we've seen him get really re-engaged in the craft of acting are when he plays characters that he played 30 years ago.
Yeah, I mean,
you know,
I think also the material has a lot to do with it. You know, I think that he sees, you know, you're in movies like Firewall and Hollywood Homicide, and you think that that's all you're getting in Hollywood. What are you going to bring to the table? I mean, obviously, yes, that's up to the actor to bring something to it. But at the same time, I get the feeling in interviews and things like that Harrison Ford just, like, he saw this shift in Hollywood in the late 90s and was just like, well, I'm not going to compete with CGI monsters, so what do I have
right.
to play? You know? And now he's actually getting these scripts that are asking a little bit more of the characters. And I feel like he's damn near 90 years old or whatever he is, like, he's reinvigorated, and he moves and looks and acts in this movie like, I don't know, he has that old-time Harrison Ford complexity that I missed. But what...
I think he does really good. He has a good dynamic with Ryan Gosling, who is
yeah.
good in this movie. Ryan Gosling is, you know, basically in every scene in the movie, and I don't know that anybody... this is a sci-fi movie with a big budget, and I don't know how seriously anybody is going to take this come award season, but, you know, again, I'm not saying it's an award performance, but Ryan Gosling is consistently, I think, now capable of carrying movies like this.
Yeah, he has some damn good simmer he's got going on. You know, that dude can simmer. He's really, the whole movie is his story, and it's crazy that we haven't even talked about that character yet, but one last thing about Ford and Leto is I so wish I had been on set for the feud between Jared Leto and Harrison Ford, because on one end, he's got like this, like the most no BS pragmatic, like, what are you talking about actor we have. And on the other end, you've got like the most, you know, highfalutin kind of method pretentious actor we have, and they're playing off of each other. And in the movie, it works really well, but at the same time, like, I wonder on set if Leto was, like, doing, like, crazy exercises while Ford was, like, burning one in the corner or something, you know?
It's like he's completely off, like no cameras are set up or rolling, and he's just sitting in the makeup chair next to Harrison Ford. You know, in a way, aren't we all blind? And Harrison Ford's just, man, what the fuck are you talking about?
I can see fine. Yeah,
yeah. I think I don't know if you want to take this in another direction, but Harrison Ford. You know, he doesn't show up in the movie until, would you say, basically like the beginning of the third act or maybe the end of the second act? I mean, and I have to say, basically, the entire part of the movie that is spent in Las Vegas is totally astounding to me. It is just incredible visually, it's very different from the rest of the movie. Just the sort of like color palette of that part of the movie. But also, even more so, I mean, it takes this idea that we talked about earlier of the kind of failed utopia just to another level entirely. And if the dump scene, the San Diego dump scene is the bottom of it, where it's the most disturbing and visceral and violent, this Las Vegas sequence is kind of the opposite end of that, where everything's just really quiet, and everything even is still kind of nice, but in a way it's even more depressing because, you know, like when they reactivate the weird little holograph Elvis show, you know, it's all of this, it had I have this weird kind of obsession that I sometimes come across on the internet of abandoned malls and theme parks, and those photos of those kind of always really set me off because I think at some point somebody built this and they thought everything is going great in the world. Like, this, what a great place we live in where something like this is possible. And now it's ruined. It's nothing anymore. It's just a reminder of how everything good we try to do ultimately will end in ruin. And that's what that whole sequence I think was just underlining is that Harrison Ford's character has now isolated himself in this place where, you know, it's a good reflection of what he would sort of consider his life story up to that point, which is, I tried to make something great in this world and tried to do something special. And in the end, it all got wiped out and it was all for nothing. And now I'm just here in the ruins of it, basically. I just found that entire section of the movie to just be so amazing. I couldn't take my eyes off it.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, it was the first kind of real image that I saw from the movie in that first trailer when Gosling is kind of walking into the desert and it's that striking orange hellscape. And I, like, from that moment, I was like, okay, so like not like that looks like totally something that would be in Blade Runner, in the world of Blade Runner, but it doesn't look anything like what we saw in the original movie. So it's like, okay, I know that they are taking this world and expanding it, you know? And, I mean, that whole section is great. That sequence, I mean, there's a part where Harrison Ford, like, punches Ryan Gosling, like, 17 times in a row that I was like, this is getting a little bit over the top, but the setting and the moment of it was so captivating that I was like, please don't end.
It also has that scene, that section of the movie also has the really probably the only real moment of levity in the movie, the only real big like actual laugh out loud that I had, which happens when Harrison Ford, when Deckard has run into basically a garage and locks the door behind him, like shortly after that, and then
Gosling,
Ryan Gosling character just busts through the wall anyway. That was. It didn't feel out of place. It was just kind of, it was the weirdly comedic beat.
Oh, people pop for that. That and people pop for him, you know, telling him, like, ask the dog if he's a replicant, which I think was a nice kind of nod to the whole is Deckard a replicant thing.
Right.
If the dog is kind of a stand-in, it's kind of like, well, we're not going to address that. Another thing that I laughed at that Danielle gave me a real ugly look for laughing at was when Love, the bad lady android, kills Robin Wright's chief character, who I think was, both of those performances are fantastic.
Yeah, very strange, yeah.
She kills her, and then she uses her face as like a like facial recognition thing to get into her computer. And then she just drops Robin Wright like
Robin Wright sold the hell out of that too.
And her head bounces off the table and she crumbles to the floor. And I like let out a laugh and I was the only one. But it was just like, holy shit, like such disregard for life and for this human being that we've kind of come to like, despite her being the symbol of, you know, suppression and stuff. She's still a likable, interesting character, and then she's just treated like straight up garbage. It's brutal.
It was a quality sell.
It's a bump, yeah. So she took a bump for the business.
Yeah,
for sure.
She did, yeah.
A good way to maybe wrap up is something that is talking about Ryan Gosling's character and also the spoilers. I remember when reviews started coming out, I think Scott Weinberg tweeted that, whatever you do, don't read any reviews for this movie that's like very easily spoiled. And I was like, oh, okay, thanks, man. And then I, you know, successfully avoided everything. And sure enough, you know, I'm in this big IMAX theater. I don't remember any of the trailers really. And I know that Ryan Gosling plays a Blade Runner, kind of like Rick Deckard. And from what, minute 5 or something like that, it's revealed that he's a replicant, which is an important plot point, sets up the entire movie. But the fact that I had no clue, and the fact that that immediately reframed the story that I was expecting was so refreshing and so wonderful that in that moment I was like, yes, this is why spoilers are important. Like, this is why it's okay to get upset about spoilers, even for things that are in the first 5 minutes of the movie, because I don't want to have that frame of reference going into a movie, you know? Like, that impacted how I watched the film, and I think that thing about it is what makes this movie special. The guts to have, you know, to whatever, try to, I don't know if they're really doing this, but try to kick off this new franchise by, A, making your main character pretty reprehensible, making him a robot, and then killing him at the end after he's kind of come kind of close to having some sort of self-actualization. I feel like that arc and his character is the strongest thing about this movie, and also, again, like, the fact that it was all contained to this viewing experience for me totally impacted the way that I digested everything.
Yeah, I am glad that I didn't know anything about his character going into the movie. I halfway thought while watching it, would have been cool if they could have kept from us whether Harrison Ford is in it or not, but again, probably sure. Not possible. But it almost feels like they were trying to with how late he's introduced into the movie. But I think the sort of the arc of Joe is really one of the major takeaways of the movie, and it works even though this movie is still at its best when it's not so focused on plot. I think this idea that, you know, this is a guy who has trouble realizing whether he should do anything about what's going on, whether it's his place to, or whether he even wants to do anything about the world he lives in. And some of it, you know, even at a certain point, he finds out that he's not even the sort of main character of his own story. I mean, obviously he is in the movie, but, you know, he's not the sort of messiah. It's not all about him. He's just a side player in all of this. And I think his decision to still do something anyway that wasn't really for his own good didn't benefit him at all. But it could help the world that he's in somehow. That to me, that's a really cool, again, Villeneuve has this way of hitting an optimistic note in these movies without coming off as cheesy or idealistic at all. I mean, he makes no bones about the fact that the world that his movies are set in is extremely dark. It's not good. And it's probably not going to get any better anytime soon. But that doesn't mean that you can't, the good can't be done, and that there's not a reason to keep going or a reason to do anything. So
right.
I think it's definitely not a sort of, you know, nihilistic view of the world, even though it is very bleak view of the world. So
no, it's definitely more optimistic than the first one, I would think.
Oh yeah, for sure. You know, I think it's got a very interesting. Again, it just feels very timely. I'm sure in the way that Blade Runner did too, and there's a lot more going on to it too. I really do want to eventually rewatch it again, and there are things that I was noticing and sort of putting together towards the end of it that I probably still haven't even made sense of yet. I think it's really interesting that there's so many knives being used in the movie.
And
there's got to be something to that. I haven't really figured it out, but it's not even all about the fact that that's kind of the main weapon everybody hurts each other with. It's also, you know, it's also used as a tool by Joe several times to kind of help him with his investigation, and it's obviously what Harrison Ford was using to make his little figures for his child, you know. So I think there's something going on. There's a lot of layers in what he made here.
Joe is stabbed in the side like 15 times in the movie. That's his kind of like recurring injury, which is crises.
I bet there are 50 times as many stabbing wounds in this movie as there are gunshots, which is very unusual for a movie in which guns even exist. So I think there's clearly something that he's pointing to there.
Why don't we ban knives? You know, they're clearly dangerous. This movie makes the point. Anyway.
I think that to me more than anything else ties this movie to the original and makes it a worthy successor and makes it exciting to watch, because this is a guy who I think didn't just go and say, I want to make a movie set in that world and using the narrative ideas from that movie. He, I think, wanted to make a movie that felt like that movie and expressed something along the same, you know, same emotional and tonal feelings. And we didn't even mention the Zimmer score yet, but it sounds totally right in line to me with the Vangelis score from the original, and in a good way. I think
it's scarier.
It's toned down from that original, I think, but there are moments where it's kind of transporting in a way. It takes you back to and makes you feel like you're watching a movie from a different era, and that's to me what was cool about rewatching Blade Runner last week too. And this just hit all the same places in my brain, in my emotional centers, I think, that the original did. And that's so much more important to me than answering some kind of nagging narrative question from the original movie.
Oh, absolutely. I remember, maybe it was like a podcast I was listening to like 10 years ago, and they were talking about what if they ever made a Blade Runner 2. And I was thinking, you know, I would be okay with that, because that's a world I would love spending time in, and I would love to see more of that world. I would not like to see a Blade Runner 2 that's all about Deckard, you know, Roy Batty being resurrected and Deckard going and fighting him again and all this other, you know. I don't want a crappy, you know, rehash of the first movie. I want a little bit more time spent in this world. And I feel like that's what we got. The weakest part of this movie is when they call back to the first one over and over again. And I think they do kind of misrepresent that first movie a little bit, and kind of they paint this Rachel Deckard relationship as being like this great love story, and you know, all of that.
Yeah,
it's so
really
beautiful.
Feel like
it's
like, that, yeah.
He kind of like, I don't know, there's the rapey element, you know, there's definitely a subjection element to that in the first movie that I think is intentional and intentionally ugly. So it's like, it's not like it's Han and Leia, you know, at all. And
all the romance actually happened in between the two movies.
Apparently, yeah, they went to counseling. They went to replicant marriage counseling.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff where they kind of elegize, if that's even a word, the original movie, those are the weakest parts of Blade Runner 2049. It's kind of like Force Awakens, you know, all the stuff of the new character, I feel like that arc is so good that it just does everything for me. And even the Harrison Ford stuff, I think the best stuff is him reacting to the new things. You know, the last moment is amazing, partly because of his performance, but also because his world has totally changed, you know, and it's not him reliving a moment that we saw in the movie, you know, 25 years ago. So right. I think that, 35 years ago? I think that, yeah, so that's kind of my takeaway is I got exactly what I wanted, which is more time in the Blade Runner universe. And, yeah, it's like you said, the long runtime, the silence, the long beats of, you know, just looking at somebody's face or watching a vehicle fly through the air and past buildings. That's the kind of stuff that it's like, yes, this is why we go to the movies. This is why movies are sometimes long. This is why screens are big, is so that we can be trapped in this world with these things. And, I mean, I think that there's a few fly-throughs of the city that in a way look a little bit stagier and more like miniatures than the original even, which I love. You know, it throws back to Metropolis in ways that the original
for sure.
Did. There's
I love that. I love that there are companies that have, since Blade Runner came out, have long been out of business that exist in the world of this movie. Like this is a alternate future of 1982 or whatever that still never came to be. But we're still in that same future. That little alternate future. Yeah, there's a giant Atari sign. There's like a Pan Am sign somewhere at some point. And to me, that it just connects it to something just feels so right about a movie that connects that is set in the future technically, but it connects to something from the 80s, which is what this is all about. Because we are living in, you know, the failed future of the 1980s. That's where we actually live now. And that's to me the great moments in this movie just capture something that makes you understand what it feels like to live in 2017, I think.
Absolutely. And I meant to mention this earlier when we were talking about Joe and the Gosling character, that I think there's an interesting reversal of the whole Tears and Rain speech, where in the original, obviously, Rutger Hauer, as he's dying, Roy Batty, as he's dying, kind of laments that all his memories that make him are, you know, going to go away when he dies, like lost like tears and rain. In this movie, snow kind of comes up often, and at the end, Joe dies in the snow with snowflakes coming down. And it's like, it's kind of like, it's similar to being in the rain, but the way that we think about it is different, because the whole idea is that snowflakes are unique. Snowflakes are, you know, special, and each one has something unique about it. And I think that is an interesting, reversal of that, because it's saying that, yes, like, Ryan Gosling's life is fleeting, his memories are fleeting, as fleeting as Roy Batty or any human's memories and identity. However, that doesn't mean he's not unique. That doesn't mean we're not special. That doesn't mean we're not desired, which I think is kind of like the main crux of his story. It's just this need to be desired.
His girlfriend tells him that a million times over the course of her.
Yeah, you're special.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in the whole movie, you're thinking, well, yeah, he is special because he's like this, like, you know, Christ child, but then he's not. And then you're left thinking, well, what did make him break from the mold? You know, what did make him individualistic? And then it's the logical conclusion is, well, nothing. Like, he just is, and he just had to realize that. And I think that is strong. And it's one of those movies that I walked out and had all the technical and the film nerd nitpick reactions to it mulling around my head when I went to sleep last night. And then I woke up today, and all I'm thinking about all day is that character arc and those themes. And that's what really sticks with me. That's why I think it's a great film.
I'm with you. Very, very cool movie. I'm very pleased. And I have to say, this wasn't even a movie I was anticipating nearly as much as I think you were. And
it may have been my most anticipated of the year at that one point.
It really is going to stick with me, I think. There's just a lot. A lot of ideas and imagery that I think just really clicked with me, and I'm glad. I think it's really cool that this movie came to be. I don't know how. I mean, we saw it Thursday night, so I don't know how this is going to end up doing with an American box office with this audience, but I think Villeneuve clearly, you know, has proven himself again to be, I think, one of our most interesting filmmakers working right now in any genre.
Yeah, absolutely. He's great, and I can't wait. I really hope he doesn't do Dune next. I want him to make more original movies.
For more Film Nerds Unlimited, go to filmnerds.com or find us on Facebook and Twitter. If you like what you hear, rate and review our podcast on iTunes. Keep an eye out for the next issue of Film Nerds Unlimited, coming soon.